content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today, February 21st, 2020, it's the 95th anniversary of the publishing of the first issue of the New Yorker magazine. To mark this, I'll read an article about saving democracy in the 1930s and an article asking, can we have prosperity without economic growth? I'll begin today with an article from the February 3rd, 2020 issue of the New Yorker magazine, the Future of Democracy Department. In every dark hour, in the 30s, democracy's survival was in question. What was our answer? By Jill Lepore. The last time democracy nearly died all over the world and almost all at once, Americans argued about it and then they tried to fix it. The future of democracy is topic number one in the animated discussion going on all over America, a contributor to the New York Times wrote in 1937. In the legislatures, over the radio, at the luncheon table, in the drawing rooms, at meetings of forums, and in all kinds of groups of citizens everywhere, people are talking about the democratic way of life. People bickered and people hollered, and they also made rules. You are a liar, one guy shouted from the audience during a political debate heard on the radio by 10 million Americans from Missoula to Tallahassee. Now, we don't allow that, the moderator said calmly and asked him to leave. In the 1930s, you could count on the Yankees winning the World Series, dust storms plaguing the prairies, evangelicals preaching on the radio, Franklin Delano Roosevelt residing in the White House, people lining up for blocks to get scraps of food, and democracies dying from the Andes to the Urals and the Alps. In 1917, Woodrow Wilson's administration had promised that winning the Great War would, quote, make the world safe for democracy, end quote. The peace carved nearly a dozen new states out of the former Russian, Ottoman, and Austrian empires. The number of democracies in the world rose. The spread of liberal democratic governance began to appear inevitable. But this was no more than reverie. Infant democracies grew, toddled, wobbled, and fell. Hungary, Albania, Poland, Lithuania, Yugoslavia. In older states, too, the desperate masses turned to authoritarianism. Benito Mussolini marched on Rome in 1922. It had taken a century and a half for European monarchs who ruled by divine right and brute force to be replaced by constitutional democracies and the rule of law. Now, fascism and communism toppled these governments in a matter of months. Even before the stock market crash of 1929 and the misery that ensued. Epithets for democracy are the fashion of the day, the soon-to-be Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter wrote dismally in 1930. The annus horribilis that followed differed from every other year in the history of the world, according to the British historian Arnold Toynbee. In 1931, men and women all over the world were seriously contemplating and frankly discussing the possibility that the Western system of society might break down and cease to work. When Japan invaded Manchuria, the League of Nations condemned the annexation to no avail. The liberal state is destined to perish, Mussolini predicted in 1932. All the political experiments of our day are anti-liberal. By 1933, the year Adolf Hitler came to power, the American political commentator Walter Lippmann was telling an audience of students at Berkeley that, quote, the old relationships among the great masses of the people of the earth have disappeared, end quote. What next? More epithets. Greece, Romania, Estonia, Latvia. Authoritarians multiplied in Portugal, Uruguay, Spain. Japan invaded Shanghai. Mussolini invaded Ethiopia. The present century is a century of authority, Mussolini declared, a century of the right, a fascist century. American democracy, too, staggered, weakened by corruption, monopoly apathy, inequality, political violence, hucksterism, racial injustice, unemployment, even starvation. We do not distrust the future of essential democracy, FDR said in his first inaugural address, telling Americans that the only thing they had to fear was fear itself. But there was more to be afraid of, including Americans' own declining faith in self-government. What does democracy mean? NBC Radio asked listeners. Do we Negroes believe in democracy? W.E.B. Du Bois asked the readers of his newspaper column. Could it happen here? Sinclair Lewis asked in 1935. Americans suffered and hungered and wondered. The historian Charles Beard, in the inevitable essay, The Future of Democracy in the United States, predicted that American democracy would endure if only because, there, quote, there is in America no Rome, no Berlin to march on, end quote. Some Americans turned to communism, some turned to fascism, and a lot of people worried about whether American democracy could survive past the end of the decade, and they strove to save it. It's not too late, Jimmy Stewart pleaded with Congress, rasping, exhausted, and Mr. Smith goes to Washington in 1939. Great principles don't get lost once they come to light. It wasn't too late. It's still not too late. There's a kind of likeness you see in family photographs, generation after generation. The same ears, the same funny nose. Sometimes now looks a lot like then. Still, it can be hard to tell whether the likeness is more than skin deep. In the 1990s, with the end of the Cold War, democracies grew more plentiful, much as they had after the end of the First World War. As ever, the infant mortality rate for democracies was high. Baby democracies tend to die in their cradles. Starting in about 2005, the number of democracies around the world began to fall, as it had in the 1930s. Authoritarians rose to power. Vladimir Putin in Russia, Recep Erdogan in Turkey, Viktor Orban in Hungary, Jaroslaw Kaczynski in Poland, Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, and Donald J. Trump in the United States. American democracy, as a matter of history, is democracy with the asterisk, the symbol A-Rod's name would need if he were ever inducted into the Hall of Fame. Not until the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act can the United States be said to have met the basic conditions for political equality requisite in a democracy. All the same, measured not against its past but against its contemporaries, American democracy in the 21st century is withering. The Democracy Index rates 167 countries every year on a scale that ranges from full democracy to authoritarian regime. In 2006, the U.S. was a full democracy, the 17th most democratic nation in the world. In 2016, the index for the first time rated the United States a flawed democracy. And since then, American democracy has gotten only more flawed. True, the United States still doesn't have a Rome or a Berlin to march on. That hasn't saved the nation from misinformation, tribalization, domestic terrorism, human rights abuses, political intolerance, social media mob rule, white nationalism, a criminal president, the nobbling of the Congress, a corrupt presidential administration, assaults on the press, crippling polarization, the undermining of elections, and an epistemological chaos that is the only air that totalitarianism can breathe. Nothing so sharpens one's appreciation for democracy as bearing witness to its demolition. Mussolini called Italy and Germany the greatest and soundest democracies which exist in the world today. And Hitler liked to say that with Nazi Germany, he had achieved a beautiful democracy, prompting the American political columnist Dorothy Thompson to remark of the fascist state, "If it's going to call itself democratic, we had better find another word for what we have and what we want." In the 1930s, Americans didn't find another word, but they did work to decide what they wanted and to imagine and to build it. Thompson, who had been a foreign correspondent in Germany and Austria and had interviewed the Führer, said in a column that reached 8 million readers, "Be sure you know what you prepare to defend." It's a paradox of democracy that the best way to defend it is to attack it, to ask more of it by way of criticism, protest, and dissent. American democracy in the 1930s had plenty of critics, left and right, from Mexican Americans who objected to brutal regime of forced deportations to businessmen who believed the New Deal to be unconstitutional. W.E.B. Du Bois predicted that unless the United States met its obligations to the dignity and equality of all its citizens and ended its enthrallment to corporations, American democracy would fail. If it is going to use this power to force the world into color prejudice and race antagonism, if it is going to use it to manufacture millionaires instead the rule of to manufacture millionaires, increase the rule of wealth, and break down democratic government everywhere, if it is going increasingly to stand for reaction, fascism, white supremacy, and imperialism, if it is going to promote war and not peace, then America will go the way of the Roman Empire, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote. The historian Mary Ritter Beard warned that American democracy would make no headway against its ruthless enemies, war, fascism, ignorance, poverty, scarcity, unemployment, sadistic criminality, racial persecution, man's lust for power, and woman's miserable trailing in the shadow of his frightful ways. Unless Americans could imagine a future democracy in which women would no longer be barred from positions of leadership. If we will not so envision our future, no Bill of Rights, man's or woman's, is worth the paper on which it is printed. If the United States hasn't gone the way of the Roman Empire and the Bill of Rights, it's still worth more than the paper on which it's printed. That's because so many people have been, ever since, fighting the fights Du Bois and Ritter Beard fought. There have been wins and losses. The fight goes on. Could no system of rule but extremism hold back the chaos of economic decline? In the 1930s, people all over the world, liberals, hoped that the United States would be able to find a middle road, somewhere between the malignity of a state-run economy and the mercilessness of laissez-faire capitalism. Roosevelt campaigned in 1932 on the promise to rescue American democracy by way of a New Deal for the American people. His version of that third way, relief, recovery, and reform. He won 42 of 48 states and trounced the incumbent, Herbert Hoover, in the Electoral College, 472-59. Given the national emergency in which Roosevelt took office, Congress granted him an almost entirely free hand, even as critics raised concerns that the powers he assumed were barely short of dictatorial. New Dealers were trying to save the economy. They ended up saving democracy. They built a new America. They told a new American story. On New Deal projects, people from different parts of the country labored side by side, constructing roads and bridges and dams, everything from the Lincoln Tunnel to the Hoover Dam, joining together in a common endeavor, shoulder to the wheel, hand to the forge. Many of those public works projects, like better transportation and better electrification, also brought far-flung communities down to the littlest town or the remotest farm into a national culture, one enriched with new funds for the arts, theater, music, and storytelling. With radio, more than with any other technology of communication before or since, Americans gained a sense of their shared suffering and shared ideals. They listened to one another's voices. This didn't happen by accident. Writers and actors and directors and broadcasters made it happen. They dedicated themselves to using the medium to bring people together. Beginning in 1938, for instance, FDR's Works Progress Administration produced a 26-week radio drama series for CBS called Americans All, Immigrants All, written by Gilbert Selds, the former editor of The Dial. The series, what brought people to this country from the four corners of the earth? A pamphlet distributed to school teachers explaining the series asked, what gifts did they bring? What were their problems? What problems remain unsolved? The finale celebrated the American experiment, the story of a magnificent adventure, the record of an unparalleled event in the history of mankind. There is no 21st century equivalent of Seldes' Americans All, Immigrants All. Because it is no longer acceptable for a serious artist to write in this vein, and for this audience, and for this purpose. In some quarters, it was barely acceptable even then. Love of the ordinary, affection for the common people, concern for the common weal, these were features of the best writing and art of the 1930s. They are not so often features lately. Americans reelected FDR in 1936 by one of the widest margins in the country's history. American magazines continued the trend from the 20s, in which hardly a month went by without their taking stock. Is democracy doomed? Can democracy survive? Those were the past century's versions of more recent titles such as How Democracy Ends, Why Liberalism Failed, How the Right Lost Its Mind, and How Democracies Die. The same ears, that same funny nose. In 1934, the Christian Science Monitor published a debate called Wither Democracy? The debate addressed to everyone who has been thinking about the future of democracy and who hasn't. It staked, as adversaries, two British scholars, Alfred Zimmern, a historian from Oxford, on the right, and Harold Laski, a political theorist from the London School of Economics on the left. Dr. Zimmern says, in effect, that where democracy has failed, it has not been really tried. The editors explained, and that Professor Laski sees an irrepressible conflict between the idea of political equality in democracy and the fact of economic inequality in capitalism, and expects at least a temporary resort to fascism or a capitalistic dictatorship. On the one hand, American democracy is safe. On the other hand, American democracy is not safe. Zimmern and Laski went on speaking tours of the United States, part of a long parade of visiting professors brought here to prognosticate on the future of democracy. Laski spoke to a crowd 3,000 strong in Washington's Constitution Hall. Laski tells how to save democracy, the Washington Post reported in a headline. Zimmern delivered a series of lectures titled The Future of Democracy at the University of Buffalo, in which he warned that democracy had been undermined by a new aristocracy of self-professed experts. I am no more ready to be governed by experts than I am to be governed by the ex-Kaiser, he professed expertly. The year 1935 happened to mark the centennial of the publication of Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, an occasion that elicited still more lectures from European intellectuals coming to the United States to remark on its system of government and the character of its people. They all close in on de Tocqueville's heels. Heinrich Brüning, a scholar and a former chancellor of Germany, lectured at Princeton on the crisis of democracy. The Swiss political theorist William Rapard gave the same title to a series of lectures he delivered at the University of Chicago. In The Projects for Democracy, the Scottish historian and later BBC radio quiz show panelist Dennis W. de Brogan offered little but gloom. The defenders of democracy, the thinkers and writers who still believe in its merits, are in danger of suffering the fate of Aristotle, who kept his eyes fixedly on the city-state at a time when that form of government was being reduced to a shadow by the rise of Alexander's world empire. Brogan hedged his bets by predicting the worst. It's an old trick. The endless train of academics were also called upon to contribute to the nation's growing number of periodicals. In 1937, the New Republic, arguing that at no time since the rise of political democracy have its tenets been so seriously challenged as they are today. The New Republic then ran a series on the future of democracy, featuring pieces by the likes of Bertrand Russell and John Dewey. "Do you think that political democracy is now on the wane?" the editors asked East Rider. The series' lead contributor, the Italian philosopher Benedetto Croce, took issue with the question, as philosophers thankfully do. "I call this kind of question meteorological," he grumbled. "It's like asking, do you think it's going to rain today? Had I better take my umbrella?" The trouble, Croce explained, is that political problems are not external forces beyond our control. They are forces within our control. We need solely to make up our own minds and to ask. Don't ask whether you need an umbrella. Go outside and stop the rain. Here are some of the sorts of people who went out and stopped the rain in the 1930s. School teachers, city councilors, librarians, poets, union organizers, artists, precinct workers, soldiers, civil rights activists, and investigative reporters. They knew what they were prepared to defend, and they defended it, even though they also knew that they risked attack from both the left and the right. Charles Beard, Mary Ritter's husband, spoke out against the newspaper tycoon William Randolph Hearst, the Rupert Murdoch of his day, when he smeared scholars and teachers as communists. "The people who are doing the most damage to American democracy are men like Charles A. Beard," said a historian at Trinity College in Hartford, speaking at a high school on the subject of democracy and the future, and warning against reading Beard's books. At a time when Nazis in Germany and Austria were burning un-German books in public squares. That did not exactly happen here, but in the 1930s, 4 of 5 American superintendents of schools recommended assigning only those U.S. history textbooks which omit any facts likely to arouse in the minds of the students question or doubt concerning the justice of our social order and government. Beard's books, God bless them, raised doubts. Beard didn't back down, nor did WPA muralists and artists who were subject to the same attack. Instead, Beard took pains to point out that Americans like to think of themselves as good talkers and good arguers, people with a particular kind of smarts. Not necessarily book learning, but street smarts, reasonableness, open-mindedness, level-headedness. The kind of universal intellectual prostration required by Bolshevism and fascism is decidedly foreign to American intelligence, Beard wrote. Possibly, he allowed, you could call this a stubborn independence of mind or even mulishness. Whatever the interpretation, our wisdom or ignorance stands in the way of our accepting the totalitarian assumption of omniscience, he insisted, and to this extent it contributes to the continuance of the arguing, debating, never settling anything, finally, methods of political democracy. Maybe that was whistling in the dark, but sometimes a whistle is all you've got. The more argument the better is what the North Carolina-born George V. Denny Jr. was banking on, anyway, after a neighbor of his in Scarsdale declared that he was so strongly disagreed with FDR that he never listened to him. Denny, who helped run something called the League for Political Education, thought that was absolutely nuts. In 1935, he launched America's Town Meeting of the Air, an hour-long debate program broadcast nationally on NBC's Blue Network. Each episode opened with a town crier ringing a bell and hollering, "Town meeting tonight! Town meeting tonight!" Then Denny moderated a debate, usually among three or four panelists, on a controversial subject. Examples: does the U.S. have a truly free press? Should schools teach politics? Before opening the discussion up to questions from an audience of more than 1,000 people. The debates were conducted at a lecture hall, usually in New York, and broadcast to listeners gathered in public libraries all over the country so they could hold their own debates once the show ended. We are living today on the thin edge of history, Max Lerner, the editor of The Nation, said in 1938 during a town meeting of the air debate on the meaning of democracy. His panel included a communist, an exile from the Spanish Civil War, a conservative American political economist, and a Russian columnist. "We didn't expect to settle anything, and therefore we succeeded," the Spanish exile said at the end of the hour, offering this definition. Quote, "A democracy is a place where a town meeting of the air can take place," end quote. No one expected anyone to come up with an indisputable definition of democracy, since the point was disputation. Asking people about the meaning and future of democracy and listening to them argue it out was really only a way to get people to stretch their civic muscles. "Democracy can only be saved by democratic men and women," Dorothy Thompson once said. "The war against democracy begins by the destruction of the democratic temper, the democratic method, and the democratic heart. In the democratic temper, if the democratic temper be exacerbated into wanton unreasonableness, which is the essence of the evil, then a victory has been won for the evil we despise and prepare to defend ourselves against, even though it's 3,000 miles away and has never moved." The most ambitious plan to get Americans to show up in the same room and argue with one another in the 1930s came out of Des Moines, Iowa, from a one-eyed former bricklayer named John W. Studebaker, who had become the superintendent of the city's schools. Studebaker, who after the Second World War helped create the GI Bill, had the idea of opening those schools up at night so that citizens could hold debates. In 1933, with a grant from the Carnegie Corporation and support from the American Association for Adult Education, he started a five-year experiment in civic education. The meetings began at 7:45 with a 15-minute news update, followed by a 45-minute lecture and 30 minutes of debate. The idea was that the people of the community of every political affiliation, creed, and economic view have an opportunity to participate freely. When Senator Guy Gillette, a Democrat from Iowa, talked about why I support the New Deal, Senator Lester Dickinson, a Republican from Iowa, talked about why I oppose the New Deal. Speakers defended fascism. They attacked capitalism. They attacked fascism. They defended capitalism. Within the first 9 months of the program, 13,000 of Des Moines, 76,000 adults had attended a forum. The program got so popular that in 1934, FDR appointed Studebaker the U.S. Commissioner of Education. And with the eventual help of Eleanor Roosevelt, the program became a part of the New Deal and received federal funding. The Federal Forum program started out in 10 test sites from Orange County, California, to Sedgwick County, Kansas, and Pulaski County, Arkansas. It came to include almost 500 forums in 43 states and involved 2.5 million Americans. Even people who had steadfastly predicted the demise of democracy participated. It seems to me the only method by which we are going to achieve democracy in the United States, Du Bois wrote in 1937. The federal government paid for it, but everything else fell under local control, and ordinary people made it work by showing up and participating. Usually, school districts found the speakers and decided on the topics after collecting ballots from the community. In some parts of the country, even in rural areas, meetings were held 4 and 5 times a week. They started in schools and spread to the YMCAs and the YWCAs, to labor halls, libraries, settlement houses, and businesses during lunch hours. Many of the meetings were broadcast by radio. People who went to those meetings debated all sorts of things. Here are a few examples. Should the power of the Supreme Court be altered? Do company unions help labor? Do machines oust men? Must the West get out of the East? Can we conquer poverty? Should capital punishment be abolished? Is propaganda a menace? Do we need a new constitution? Should women work? Is America a good neighbor? Can it happen here? These efforts don't always work. Still, trying them is better than talking about the weather and waiting for someone to hand you an umbrella. When a terrible hurricane hit New England in 1938, Dr. Loreen Pruett, a Tennessee-born psychologist who had written an essay called Why Women Fail, and who had urged FDR to name only women to his cabinet, found herself marooned at a farm in New Hampshire with a young neighbor, 16-year-old Alice Hooper, a high school sophomore. Waiting out the storm, they had nothing to do except listen to the news, which, needless to say, concerned the future of democracy. Alice asked Pruett a question. What is it everyone on the radio is talking about? What is this democracy? What does it mean? Somehow, in the end, NBC arranged a coast-to-coast broadcast in which 8 prominent thinkers, 2 ministers, 3 professors, a former ambassador, a poet, and a journalist, tried to explain to Alice the meaning of democracy. American democracy had found its, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus moment, except that it was messier and more interesting, because those 8 people didn't agree on the answer. Democracy, Alice, is the darndest thing. That broadcast was made possible by the workers who brought electricity to rural New Hampshire, the legislators who signed the 1934 Federal Communications Act mandating public interest broadcasting, the executives at NBC who decided that it was important to run this program, the 2 ministers, the 3 professors, the former ambassador, the poet, and the journalists who gave their time for free to a public forum and agreed to disagree without acting like asses, and a whole lot of Americans who took the time to listen carefully, even though they had plenty of other things to do. Getting out of our current jam will likely require something different, but not entirely different. And it will be worth doing. A decade-long debate about the future of democracy came to a close at the end of the 1930s, but not because it had been settled. In 1939, the World's Fair opened in Queens, with a main exhibit featuring the saga of democracy and a chipper motto, "The World of Tomorrow." The fairgrounds included a court of peace, with pavilions for every nation. By the time the fair opened, however, Czechoslovakia had fallen to Germany, and its pavilion couldn't open. Shortly afterward, Edvard Beneš, the exiled president of Czechoslovakia, delivered a series of lectures at the University of Chicago on, yes, the future of democracy, though he spoke less about the future than about the past, and especially about the terrible present. A time of violently unmoored traditions and laws and agreements. A time, quote, of moral and intellectual crisis and chaos, end quote. Soon, most funereal bunting was brought to the World's Fair. soon more funereal bunting was brought to the World's Fair to cover Poland, Belgium, Denmark, France, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands. By the time the World of Tomorrow closed in 1940, half the European hall lay under a shroud of black. The federal government stopped funding the program in 1941. Americans would take up their debate about the future of democracy in a different form, only after the defeat of the Axis. For now, there was a war to fight, and there were still essays to publish, if not about the future, then about the present. In 1943, E.B. White got a letter in the mail from the Writers' War Board asking him to write a statement about the meaning of democracy. He was a little weary of these pieces, but he knew how much they mattered. He wrote back, "Democracy is a request from a war board in the middle of a morning, in the middle of a war, wanting to know what democracy is." End quote. It meant something once, and the thing is, it still does. And now, from the February 10th, 2020 issue of the New Yorker magazine, from the Department of Finance, "The Steady State, Challenging the Wisdom of Economic Growth," by John Cassidy. Can we have prosperity without economic growth? In 1930, the English economist John Maynard Keynes took a break from writing about the problems of the interwar economy and indulged in a bit of futurology. In an essay entitled "Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren," he speculated that by the year 2030, capital investment and technological progress would have raised living standards as much as eightfold, creating a society so rich that people would work as little as 15 hours a week, devoting the rest of their time to leisure and other non-economic purposes. As striving for greater affluence faded, he predicted, "The love of money as a possession will be recognized for what it is, a somewhat disgusting morbidity." This transformation hasn't taken place yet, and most economic policymakers remain committed to maximizing the rate of economic growth. But Keynes' predictions weren't entirely off base. After a century in which GDP per person has gone up more than sixfold in the United States, a vigorous debate has risen about the feasibility and wisdom of creating and consuming ever more stuff, year after year after year. On the left, increasing alarm about climate change and other environmental threats has given birth to the degrowth movement, which calls on advanced countries to embrace zero or even negative GDP growth. The faster we produce and consume goods, the more we damage the environment, Georgos Kallas, an ecological economist at the Autonomous University of Barcelona, writes in his manifesto, "Degrowth." There is no way to both have your cake and eat it too here. If humanity is not to destroy the planet's life support systems, the global economy should slow down. In "Growth from Microorganisms to Megacities," Vaclav Smil, a Czech-Canadian environmental scientist, complains that economists haven't grasped the synergistic functioning of civilization and the biosphere. Yet they maintain a monopoly on supplying their physically impossible narratives of continuing growth that guide decisions made by national governments and companies. Once confined to the margins, the ecological critique of economic growth has gained widespread attention. At a United Nations climate change summit in September, the teenage Swedish environmental activist Greta Thunberg declared, "We are in the beginning of mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?" The degrowth movement has its own academic journals and conferences. Some of its adherents favor dismantling the entirety of global capitalism, not just the fossil fuel industry. Others envisage post-growth capitalism, in which production for profit would continue, but the economy would be reorganized along very different lines. In the influential book, Prosperity Without Growth, Foundations for the Economy of Tomorrow, Tim Jackson, a professor of sustainable development at the University of Surrey in England, calls on Western countries to shift their economies from mass market production to local services, such as nursing and teaching and handicrafts, that could be less resource intensive. Jackson doesn't underestimate the scale of the changes in social values as well as in production patterns that such a transformation would entail, but he sounds an optimistic note. Quote, people can flourish without endlessly accumulating more stuff. Another world is possible, end quote. Even within mainstream economics, the growth orthodoxy is being challenged, and not merely because of a heightened awareness of environmental perils. In Good Economics for Hard Times, two winners of the 2019 Nobel Prize in Economics, Abhijit Banerjee and Esther Duflo, point out that a larger GDP doesn't necessarily mean a rise in human well-being, especially if it isn't distributed equitably, and the pursuit of it can sometimes be counterproductive. Nothing in either of our theory or the data proves the highest GDP per capita is generally desirable, Banerjee and Duflo, a husband and wife team who teach at MIT, right? The two made their reputations by applying rigorous experimental methods to investigate what types of policy interventions work in poor communities. They conducted randomized controlled trials in which one group of people was subjected to a given policy intervention, like paying parents to keep their children in school, say, and a control group wasn't. Drawing on their findings, Banerjee and Duflo argue that rather than chase quote, the growth mirage, end quote, governments should concentrate on specific measures with proven benefits, such as helping the poorest members of society get access to health care, education, and social advancement. Banerjee and Duflo also maintain that in advanced countries like the United States, the misguided pursuit of economic growth since the Reagan-Thatcher Revolution has contributed to a rise in inequality, mortality rates, and political polarization. When the benefits of growth are mainly captured by an elite, they warn social disaster can result. That's not to say that Banerjee and Duflo are opposed to economic growth. In the recent essay for Foreign Affairs, they noted that, since 1990, the number of people living on less than $1.90 a day, the world Bank's definition of extreme poverty, fell from nearly 2 billion to around 700 million. In addition to increasing people's income, steadily expanding GDPs have allowed governments and others to spend more on schools, hospitals, medicines, and income transfers to the poor, they write. Yet for advanced countries in particular, they think policies that slow GDP growth may prove to be beneficial, especially if the result is that the fruits of growth are shared more widely. In this sense, Banerjee and Duflo might be termed slothers, a label that certainly applies to Dietrich Wollroth, an economist at the University of Houston and the author of Fully Grown, Why a Stagnant Economy is a Sign of Success. As his subtitle suggests, he thinks that slower rates of economic growth in advanced countries are nothing to worry about. Between 1950 and 2000, GDP per person in the U.S. rose at an annual rate of more than 3%. Since 2000, the growth rate has slowed to about 2%. Donald Trump has not, as he promised, boosted overall GDP growth to 4 or 5%. The phenomenon of slow growth is often bemoaned as secular stagnation, a term popularized by Lawrence Sumners, the Harvard economist and former Treasury Secretary. Yet Wollroth argues that slower growth is appropriate for a society as rich and industrially developed as ours. Unlike other growth skeptics, he doesn't base his case on environmental concerns or rise in inequality or the shortcomings of GDP as a measurement. Rather, he explains this phenomena as a result of personal choices, the core of economic orthodoxy. Volroth offers a detailed decomposition of the sources of economic growth, which uses a mathematical technique that the eminent MIT economist Robert Solow pioneered in the 1950s. The movement of women into the workplace provided a one-time boost to the labor supply. In its aftermath, other trends dragged down the growth curve. As countries like the United States have become richer and richer, Volroth points out, their inhabitants have chosen to spend less time at work and to have smaller families, the result of higher wages and the advent of contraceptive pills. GDP growth slows when the growth of the labor force declines. But this isn't any sort of failure, in Walroth's view. It reflects, quote, the advance of women's rights and economic success. Volroth estimates that about two-thirds of the recent slowdown in GDP growth can be accounted for by the decline in the growth of labor inputs. He also cites a switch in spending patterns from tangible goods, such as clothes, cars, and furniture, to services, such as childcare, healthcare, and spa treatments. In 1950, spending on services accounted for 45% of GDP. Today, the proportion is more than 70%. And service industries, which tend to be labor-intensive, exhibit lower rates of productivity growth than goods-producing industries, which are often factory-based. The person who cuts your hair isn't getting more efficient. The plant that makes his or her scissors probably is. Since rising productivity is a key component of GDP growth, that growth will be further constrained by the expansion of the service sector. But again, this isn't necessarily a failure. In the end, that reallocation of economic activity away from goods and into services comes down to our success, Volroth writes. We've gotten so productive at making goods that this has freed up our money to spend on services. Taken together, slower growth in the labor force and the shift to services can explain almost all the recent slowdown, according to Volroth. He's unimpressed by many other explanations that have been offered, such as sluggish rates of capital investment, rising trade pressure, soaring inequality, shrinking technological possibilities, or an increase in monopoly power. In his account, it all flows from the choices we've made. Quote, slow growth, it turns out, is the optimal response to massive economic success. End quote. Volroth's analysis implies that all the major economies are likely to see slower growth rates as their populations age, a pattern first established in Japan during the 1990s. But 2% growth isn't negligible. If the U.S. economy continues to expand at this rate, it will have doubled in size by 2055, and a century from now it will be almost 8 times its current size. If you think about growth compounding in other rich countries and developing economies growing at somewhat faster rates, you can readily summon up scenarios in which, by the end of the next century, global GDP has risen 50-fold or even 100-fold. Is such a scenario environmentally sustainable? Proponents of green growth, who now include many European governments, the World Bank, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and all the remaining U.S. Democratic presidential candidates, insist that it is. They say that given the right policy measures and continued technological progress, we can enjoy perpetual growth and prosperity while also reducing carbon emissions and our consumption of natural resources. A 2018 report by the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate, an international group of economists, government officials, and business leaders, declared, "We are on the cusp of a new economic era, one where growth is driven by the interaction between rapid technological innovation, sustainable infrastructure investment, and increased resource productivity. We can have growth that is strong, sustainable, balanced, and inclusive." This judgment reflected a belief in what's sometimes termed absolute decoupling, a prospect in which GDP can grow while other carbon emissions decline. The environmental economists Alex Bowen and Cameron Hepburn have conjectured that by 2050, absolute decoupling may appear, quote, to have been a relatively easy challenge, end quote, as renewables become significantly cheaper than fossil fuels. They endorse scientific research into green technology and hefty taxes on fossil fuels. But they also oppose the idea of stopping economic growth. From an environmental perspective, they write, it would be counterproductive. Recessions have slowed and in some cases derailed efforts to adopt cleaner modes of production. It's now clear that any comprehensive degrowth strategy would have to deal with distributional conflicts in the developed world and poverty in the developing world. As long as GDP is steadily rising, all groups in society can, in theory, see their living standards rise at the same time. Beckerman argued that this was the key to avoiding such conflict. But if growth were abandoned, helping the worst off would pit winners against losers. The fact that in many Western countries over the past couple of decades, slower growth has been accompanied by rising political polarization suggests that Beckerman may have been onto something. More recently, Callas and other degrowthers have called for the introduction of a universal basic income, which would guarantee people some level of subsistence. Last year, when progressive Democrats unveiled their plan for a Green New Deal, aiming to create a zero-emission economy by 2050, it included a federal job guarantee. Some backers also advocate a universal basic income. Yet, Green New Deal proponents appear to be in favor of green growth rather than degrowth. Some sponsors of the plan have even argued that it would eventually pay for itself through economic growth. There's another challenge for growth skeptics. How would they reduce global poverty? China and India lifted millions out of extreme deprivation by integrating their countries into the global capitalist economy, supplying low-cost goods and services to more advanced countries. The process involved mass urban, rural-to-urban migration, the proliferation of sweatshops, and environmental degradation. But the eventual result was higher incomes and, in some places, the emergence of a new middle class that is loath to give up its gains. If major industrial economies were to cut back their consumption and reorganize along more communal lines, who would buy all the components and gadgets and clothes that developing countries like Bangladesh, Indonesia, and Vietnam produce? What would happen to the economies of African countries such as Ethiopia, Ghana, and Rwanda, which have seen rapid GDP growth in recent years, as they, too, have started to join the world economy? Degrowthers have yet to provide a convincing answer to these questions. Given the scale of the environmental threat and the need to lift up poor countries, some sort of green growth policy would seem to be the only option, but it may involve emphasizing green over growth. Kate Raworth has proposed that we adopt environmentally sound policies even when we're uncertain how they will affect the long-term rate of growth. There are plenty of such policies available. To begin with, all major countries could take more definitive steps to meet their Paris Agreement commitments by investing heavily in renewable sources of energy, shutting down any remaining coal-fired power plants, and introducing a carbon tax to discourage the use of fossil fuels. According to Ian Perry, an economist at the World Bank, a carbon tax of $35 per ton, which would raise the price of gasoline by about 10% and the cost of electricity by roughly 25%, would be sufficient for many countries, including China, India, and the United Kingdom, to meet their emissions pledges. A carbon tax of this kind would raise a lot of money, which could be used to finance green investments or reduce other taxes, or even be handed out to the public as a carbon dividend. To ameliorate the effects of slower GDP growth, policies such as work sharing and universal basic income could also be considered, especially if the warnings about artificial intelligence eliminating huge numbers of jobs turns out to be true. In the United Kingdom, the New Economics Foundation has called for the standard work week to be shortened from 35 to 21 hours, a proposal that harks back to Victor's modeling in Keynes's 1930 essay. Proposals like these would have to be financed by higher taxes, particularly on the wealthy, but that redistributive aspect is a feature, not a bug. In a low-growth world, it is essential to share what growth there is more equitably. Otherwise, as Beckerman argued many years ago, the consequences could be catastrophic. Finally, rethinking economic growth may well require loosening the grip on modern life exercised by competitive consumption, which undergirds the incessant demand for expansion. Keynes, a Cambridge aesthete, believed that people whose basic economic needs have been satisfied would naturally gravitate to other non-economic pursuits, perhaps embracing the arts and nature. A century of experience suggests that this was wishful thinking. As Walworth writes, reversing consumerism, financial, and cultural dominance in public and private life is set to be one of the 21st century's most gripping psychological dramas. Well, we have time for a couple of cartoons. The first one takes place in the bedroom of a married couple. The husband is sitting on the end of the bed, fully clothed. The wife is in her underwear, looking into her clothes closet, picking out dresses. And the husband says, "Really? What's the point in being married if we still have to get dressed and go out?" Next, we see two cats sitting on the kitchen floor. A unopened can of cat food is in between them. And one cat says to the other, "Well, I'll send for my tech guy." Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For our comments or questions, and I'd love to get some comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138 or send me an email to info@ncreadingservice.org. Well, that's it for today. I'd like to just say happy birthday. Happy 95th birthday to the New Yorker. And until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.